This week, my guest on this special edition of the programme, Archbishop Robin Eames, has led Ireland's largest Protestant denomination, the Church of Ireland, as the primate of all Ireland for the past 20 years. Lord Eames steps down as Archbishop of Armagh on the 31st of December. Archbishop Sean Brady, the Catholic primate, has led Ireland's largest Christian denomination with more than 4 million members as Archbishop of Armagh for the past decade. Dr. David Clark was installed last June as Presbyterian moderator, the public face of Northern Ireland's largest Protestant church with just under 300,000 members. And the Reverend Ivan McElhinney has had a varied life, to say the least. He's worked as a farmer in a Donegal tweed company, served as a missionary in the Americas, as minister in Ireland, and he was installed as Irish Methodist president last June. Good morning to you all. You're very welcome to the programme. I want to start with a very easy question to all of you, because we've got lots of tough questions still to come. What is the most important challenge facing Ireland's churches today? Lord Eames.
I think there's no doubt in my mind that it's how can you make the message that we believe is important for society to hear, how can you make it relevant in a very secular age where people are asking questions that aren't always based on traditional Christian outlook, living lifestyles that aren't necessarily the traditional way of living and from a Christian point of view, and above all, society asking questions about what is important. And I think the church has got to come to terms with the fact that people don't necessarily be a captive audience anymore. You've got to find new ways of expressing the eternal message.
So it's a challenge of staying in touch.
It's a challenge of staying in touch, but it's also a big, big challenge of communication. How do we communicate what we think is important?
Archbishop Brady?
I think it's the place of religion in society. A proper understanding of what the church is. It's not just a moral teacher, it's also the presence of Christ in the world, the body of Christ, trying to bring his healing compassion to the world that is often very broken and much in need of that compassion. And that presupposes people who will listen. If people don't pay any heed to it, they can't appreciate to it. But my experience is, certainly in my own life, the church is very important. And the people I serve, the people I will be going out to this afternoon to celebrate 50 years of their church in a small village in County Armagh, who have been preparing for weeks, the church is vitally important to them. And that's why they want to celebrate.
You could have given this answer 200 years ago to the question I asked, though, couldn't you? As a challenge,
of course,
making the message relevant.
Making the message relevant to the times in which we're in, trying to find, it's the same message, it's good news, it's life-giving news. The challenge is to find a place where people will listen to that news, and to present it in terms in which it is found to be life-giving.
Ivan McElhinney, Methodist President.
Well, I think really it's to tell the story of Jesus, who has conquered death and lives forever. And it brings hope to all those who trust and believe. That basically is the message we have to give, and we need to find culturally meaningful ways to communicate it, as has been said. I think that is the challenge that lies before the church in every age and generation, and it's the challenge that we face now.
David Clark?
Yes, it's not just the challenge of the last 200 years, to take up your own phrase, but it's the challenge of the last 2,000 years to obey the command of Jesus Christ to go into all the world and preach the gospel, to make disciples of all nations. That's particularly difficult in our society, where there's a declining knowledge even of the basic facts of the Christian story. And the challenge for the church is to be salt and light in our society.
Has the Christian message changed much in 2,000 years? The public presentation of the message clearly has changed, but in terms of, for example, the moral teaching or the political teaching, not the key theological doctrines of the church, I'm suggesting, has the message changed?
I think we've become maybe more nuanced in the way we've presented things, and we've become aware maybe of some of the errors of presentation.
It's just a presentational change.
Well, I think attitudes have changed as well, and we've come to realise more and more how the Christian ethic impacts on society.
But is it not also true that while our message may not have changed, what the expectation of people is may have changed? That, in fact, we're trying to say you probably need today to hear this message even more clearly than perhaps you have in past generations, because things are now coming to the surface, issues are now coming to the surface, which are seriously questioning us in how we present a message that we believe is the dimension people need to hear.
Well, this is clearly what I'm getting at, in that 200 years ago, we wouldn't have been talking about the environmental challenge that we talk about often today, or about gay marriage, or about euthanasia and infanticide debates that are now on the front pages of newspapers on a weekly basis. And people will often judge the church leaders and the churches not by the timeless truths, the theological truths that you're all agreed on, it seems, but on your response to those current message issues.
But that's inevitable, William. That's inevitable. People will
question... How are you doing in terms of that judgment?
Well, I think that we are adapting very, very clearly to a presentation of issues, not necessarily giving people the easy answer. There's a phrase that's coming more and more to the fore, which is the hard gospel. The whole question of the gospel imperative is hard. It's demanding. It's questioning us. How you relate that to issues such as you have just mentioned, that is true of each generation. What we are now facing is how we present what is important to us in a way which people in society say, we need to hear that message.
Ian Hoey in Lisburn says, in the greater Lisburn area, there are 22 different Christian sects. And some of those sects do not regard the others as true Christians. The Presbyterians do not regard the Roman Catholics as true Christians, and vice versa. The Elam Pentecostals do not think the Presbyterians are true Christians. The Congregationalists are unsure about the Elam's credentials, and most sects are dubious about the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Seventh-day Adventists. How can all those sects come out of the same so-called good book, David Clark?
Well, there's a lot of very sweeping generalisations in there.
Challenge
the first one. I mean, about give me the quote again, William, please.
The Presbyterians do not view the Roman Catholics as true believers.
Well, that's not true. I mean, there would be in our Presbyterian Church some who might well regard the Roman Catholic Church as not a Christian church.
He may have a particular church in Lisbon.
Yes, he may well do. In fact, but I mean, while there are significant differences between ourselves and the Roman Catholic Church, the thing we'd have to recognise, some of us would say that the Roman Catholic Church is a Christian church with error. I mean, and Sean Brady and I...
And some would say it's not a church at all.
In the Presbyterian Church?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Is that true?
There may well be some who take that view. But I mean, I think the general...
Some of your colleagues in the ministry.
Well, the stated position of our church is quite clear, that we accept the Roman Catholic Church as a Christian church.
Archbishop Brady, do you accept that the church that David Clark is moderator of is a full Christian church in the fullest sense of that term?
I accept that David Clark and I and Robin Eames, we all have been baptized in the name of the Father, Son and Holy Spirit. We are followers of Christ. We have a huge amount in common. And that came home to me most powerfully when I stood up to preach in Fitzroy Presbyterian Church some years ago. We recited the same creed together.
But is the Presbyterian Church in Ireland a Christian church in the fullest sense of that term?
They describe themselves as a Christian church, and
they
describe themselves
as Christian. But you accept that they're a Christian church in the fullest sense of that term?
In the same sense as their own church, no. But we have. That doesn't mean that we haven't a huge amount in common, and we work together, and we have been working. That was together over these years. But of course, having said that, the division of Christians is a scandal. That's the important thing. It is a scandal, and it's a big obstacle to credibility of people outside.
The scandal in the fact that you are not able to acknowledge that.
The scandal that there is not the way we are not showing to the world the visible unity which Christ wants.
Is Robin Eames' church a full Christian church?
I'm not going to answer this kind of interrogation over
this. But this is the question that's been raised. How can people take Christian
that the
churches
divisions
seriously
are
when you
divisions
cannot agree with each other about
we can agree with each other about the creeds which we recited in the Anglican Cathedral in Armagh last Thursday evening, which I recited in Presbyterian churches early this year. We agree about that, and that's a huge amount to be agreed about. That puts us together on a huge amount.
William, with respect, an argument like this is going to get us absolutely nowhere. I always try to address this issue of our divisions on the grounds that the very facet of Christ himself was a mission to a very, very varied world. Now, the response of all our denominations to that is, first of all, the basic belief in God, in the Trinity, and in the way in which we respond as human beings to this. I was interested to see the list from Lisburn didn't include the Church of Ireland, which makes me worried a little bit.
My two colleagues
are arguing the bit out of this one. But in all seriousness, what we have got to do in a discussion like this is to recognize that we are all responding to the one God. And our churches in our doctrines may vary, but the fact is we are responding to the central fact of
God. And everybody has a part to play in this who is a follower of Christ. And we must emphasize the unity that is there for the good. The tendency is, of course, to relegate religion to the margins, and that's not good for society. And society is recognizing that. It's recognizing in advance that where the value is going to come from unless we give religion its due place and attribute to the wisdom of the ages
that,
its value.
That's a key point. I want to return to that because we're going to talk about the values in a minute. I just want to widen this beyond Christian denominations to another question people have raised about other faiths. And that is whether people from other faith groups like Jews, like Muslims, like Hindus, can be saved in your understanding. Can they be saved in the judgment of God? Ivan McElhinney, what do you say to that?
Well, I think we have to leave the judgment with God. I entirely agree with what has been said about the central core of Christian truth as far as the Christian churches are concerned. The central core of truth that is found in Scripture and in the main tradition of the Church and the creeds of the Church, those are the things which unite us, and those are the things that we all adhere to and believe and can cooperate in spreading that message throughout the world. That is very important, despite all the divisions that have arisen in the course of history. As far as other religions are concerned, they believe in God in their own way. They have their own beliefs and traditions, and there is an increasing effort in our time to seek commonality and goodwill with all those who have a spiritual emphasis, whatever that spiritual emphasis is. And the religions of the world have been trying in our time to come together to foster understanding.
Okay.
And that is a good thing.
Dave Clark, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I mean,
there are people who are listening to this who are from other faith backgrounds, and they're wondering what your view of that is.
We as Christians believe that Jesus Christ is the only way to God the Father, but we also accept the view of the Old Testament. You know, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? We leave it there.
It's an open question. It's possible that a faithful Jew could be saved.
Well, I mean, that's between them and their relationship with God.
Archbishop?
Well, I think every human person is made in the image and likeness of God and certainly can be saved by following their conscience and doing what is right and good.
So a faithful Muslim
would be saved? Of course.
There's a difference of opinion here.
Well, I have no problem with this at all. I believe man is made in the image of God. How that person responds to the central position of the God that we accept, we believe in, the interpretation of that faith, you will see a relevancy in this right across the whole spectrum of faiths, William. And I think, quite honestly, sometimes when we zone in on one of these irrelevancies, there is a sense in which we get the whole thing out of proportion.
Why is it irrelevant whether Muslims are saved or not?
It's not. I'm not saying that that issue is irrelevant. I'm simply saying that when we attack it from a point of view of saying, either you believe it my way, or you do it my way, or you follow my way, you're wrong. That is not the way in which I believe over my lifetime, and certainly in my faith, my practice of my belief, that I view other people.
But wouldn't what you've just described characterize a lot of Christianity in Northern Ireland?
Oh, of course it would, and you can bring this right back to the situation.
It's hardly irrelevant then to critique that.
It is irrelevant to the extent that it's irrelevant in terms of how we regard people who are born by an accident of birth into a different set of values. We are still believing in a God whose son died for mankind.
And the bigger challenge is to give respect for all faith communities, for religious faith in the world today, in a secular society which wants to relegate religious faith to the sidelines and say it's a private matter, it's a matter of preference, what happens. But the thing is that religious faith has an important contribution to make, and the European Union, after a number of years of saying disregarding the voice of religion, has come to realise that, and through the work of Keck and the Catholic Commissie in Brussels, by a process of dialogue, respectful dialogue, not mischievous dialogue, they have now see the value of religion, the importance of religion in...
But you recognise that there are some people who are very threatened by the idea that religion should have any kind of constitutional place or recognition within the European Union.
But that needs to be challenged, to say that down through the ages, religion has played a part in stabilising society. See, society
no
wants it both
that.
Ways. They want,
to
relegate,
the
they want to relegate religion to the sidelines and at the same time use the social capital that religion provides. You can't have it both ways.
We've got many other topics beyond these first two kind of intellectual topics on moral issues, on science, on politics. Let me kind of push you through some of these. This is pretty speedy. On my blog, Gile asks, do you really think the world was created in 6 days? David Clark.
Well, I think sometimes we've become terribly obsessed with this. People believe in creation and evolution and so on. Anybody who reads the Bible will recognize that the opening chapters of Genesis are of a different nature from the rest of that book, for instance. If you're asking me personally, I'm a Christian, I'm a theistic evolutionist. It could well be that evolution over a long period of centuries and millennia is the way in which God acts. Science addresses the question, how did this world come about? The Bible addresses the question, who brought this world into being? So religion and science in this issue are addressing separate questions. Evolution over a long period is the way in which God brings the world into being. I could live with that. God is the creator. It's his world.
There's a public policy implication for this, Ivor McElhinney, because some people want to teach creationism within the public schools of Northern Ireland. That is, to teach the view that the world was created about 6,000 years ago in 4004 BC, according to the dating of one of Archbishop Eanes' predecessors, Archbishop Usher. Do you think that creationism has any place, Ivan McElhinney, in the public schools of Northern Ireland, in the teaching curriculum?
Well, basically, I think that the Bible tells us that God created the world, and it is science that tells us how God created the world. And that has always been my view of it. The Bible tells us that it was God who made everything. It's a very ancient document. It comes from an ancient culture.
Let me just bring you back to this question about the public schools. I understand what you're saying on this, but there are those who say we should not just teach evolution. We should teach evolution and its opponent, if you like, creationism, in the schools.
If you're asking me, do I think that the children in the schools should be taught without any equivocation that God created the world in 6 days, I do not believe that they should be taught that.
I don't think the creationists are suggesting that either. They simply want their perspective to be included in the conversation. Do you think it should be included?
I have no difficulty with it as a perspective. No difficulty at all, provided due
in
regard...
In a science curriculum?
Yes, okay, in a science curriculum, provided there is the understanding that God lies behind everything that is being examined in science.
Clearly the government, science ministers, take a different view, Robin Eanes, and suggest that creationism is a religious perspective that doesn't belong in the science teaching of schools.
We see, what my difficulty with this is not just the fact of it, but the way in which certain politicians, certain ministers are raising it up to the level of what they call religion. It's a question of definition. What is it that they are describing as religion? I, like the Methodist president, have absolutely no problem with the way in which schools can put before young people all the various interpretations. But I would like to think a child or a young person from one of the homes of the Church of Ireland would be able to say, well, my teaching is this. I have to evaluate these things. I've got to work out which is a description, which is a fact. I think it's important to see that in terms of science will continue to give us particular interpretations of how things happened. My role as a church leader, my role as a priest, is to try and put before people that this is all part of God's creation.
You believe in evolution?
I believe that there is an interpretation of evolution which is important to the Christian. I still believe that this is God's world.
You agree with David Clark, you're a theistic evolutionist.
I have a great deal of sympathy with the modern.
Is that where you are?
I think the most important thing is that the world was in fact created by God. And therefore, the world owes reverence and respect to God.
And the Catholic Church has kind of changed its view on evolution over the last few decades, has it not?
I think so, yes.
To a point of
But as I say, the important thing is to realise that we have been created, we're not self-made, therefore we owe reverence, respect, worship, and we need to find time, a Sabbath day in which to worship God. That's the important talk that's been neglected.
I'll ask you about Sabbatarianism in a second. Richard Dawkins is not asking a question this morning, but he is being quoted by some people who are asking a question about the God who is being suggested as the creator of the world. Richard Dawkins has recently described God as a psychotic. I'm quoting him here, he is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, he says. This will seem blasphemous to many people, of course. A vindictive, bloodthirsty, ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. Now, that's not a description of Richard Dawkins, I hasten to add. That's his description of the God of the Old Testament. And he argues, and he has done so across the world recently, that this kind of belief in a God produces religions which underwrite violence across the world. Archbishop Eames, do you have any sympathy for him?
No, none at all. I find, first of all, from the personal faith of a person who believes in their faith, who practices it, I think that description that you have just given is extremely hurtful. I would also go further to say that it's a very one-sided, from a very brilliant man whose works I've read, but I think it's a very one-sided interpretation of the role of God in the creation story. I believe, and I'm being quite honest with you, I believe in a very personal picture of God. I find in the incarnation, the birth and life and death of Jesus, the real dimension to life that I believe I want to share with people. Now, when you come across a very brilliant scientist or a person in the scientific world making remarks like this, I have to ask myself, where does that fit in to the interpretation that I'm convinced ordinary people need to give to all these events?
Clearly he's
and
talking,
I don't see a relevance in it.
Clearly he's talking about the God of the Old Testament. He sees a relevance in that we talk a lot about religion and violence across the world today, and we have to explain the really quite heady cocktail that sometimes emerges in terms of Islamic and Christian violence across the world. Now, you've been talking about Jesus. He's talking about the God of the Old Testament, he says. And David Clark, let me put this to you. Richard Dawkins says, you read a text like the conquest of Canaan, the promised land text, and in this text a God is shown telling the people of Israel to go into that land which is not currently in their possession, to kill all the men, women and children in that land, then to kill all the animals, then to torch the land itself. Richard Dawkins says that genocide is ethnic cleansing. How can you deny that?
That's one small story in the vast sweep of the Old Testament.
It's a very key text, isn't it, the Promised Land?
There are lots of key texts in the Old Testament. I mean, and there's so much in the Old Testament about the mercy and the loving kindness of
God. Well, how do you deal with that text?
To take that particular Hebrew, the Baal, as you know, William the Harem, it says this. I mean, I'm not defending it, but this, bear in mind, in those days, the Harem, the Baal, the total annihilation of the enemy, indicated that the battle wars were fought for the good, for the God, on behalf of the gods. Nowadays, we fight war for human profit, for control of the oil wells of the Middle East, for controls in the past of the riches of the mineral wealth of Africa. So, in a sense, there's that to be said in defence of it. But there's so much in the rest of the
Old Testament.
But do
you see a God sanctioning genocide in that text?
It was a particular juncture in Hebrew history. The protection of and the development of the insight that the Hebrews had into the greatness of the monotheistic God. And that there was a light and a truth that the Hebrews had at that point.
Well, that sounds like you're saying, yes, he did, but he doesn't do it very often in the Bible.
Yes. But I mean, I think you mustn't run away from the fact that the goodness and the mercy of God that's in the Old Testament.
True,
the
but I mean, people will be concerned about these. There are scores of other texts that people will talk about. Archbishop Brady, what's your take on this? Is this genocide?
Well, it certainly creates problems, but the God, we have moved on from that to the God of Jesus Christ.
Right.
The God revealed by
God?
Jesus Christ. Not a different God, but the God revealed by Jesus Christ, the God we believe in, the God who
surely
gave
his
Son.
There must be some consistency between the God who's imaged in that text and the God in Jesus Christ.
Well, that image needs to be corrected by the later revelation in Jesus
corrected.
Christ.
Corrected?
out, yes, I think so.
Developed.
It creates problems, there's no doubt about that. But the point we are at the moment is that the face of Jesus Christ is what reveals God, a God who brings compassion and forgiveness and healing. And
are you a bit embarrassed about the God of the Old Testament?
Well, I'm more fascinated by the God of the New Testament. And
let's be honest about this. You can put all the interpretations you want on the Old Testament. You can read history, modern history, from any aspect you want. I'm absolutely certain that the real role that we four, try to represent as leaders of our churches is that we're speaking of a God of love, God of compassion, a God of reconciliation.
Okay.
And we're trying to address that in a world of contradictions, a world of these issues. You could pick on any aspect,
you could,
science or anything else, and say, look, you've got a problem with your past.
Stay with that God of forgiveness.
Please. Yes,
because he's very relevant to our situation here at the moment.
Let's develop an interpretation of the God who's imaged in Jesus Christ in terms of one of the moral questions we're facing today. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists have called for a public debate on whether doctors should be permitted to help a baby that is very severely disabled die. Do you believe, Ivan McElhinney, do you believe that it is sometimes right to help a child in those very distressing circumstances to die?
Well, of course, this question could be widened out to people of any age who are near to the end of their lives, for whom there is no future in this life. And there are all sorts of judgments to be made about that. But the whole question of the care of the terminally ill is a very sensitive and difficult subject. And the palliative care, as to whether it should continue to be exercised beyond a certain point and all that sort of thing. And here again, morals and moral perspectives differ on these things.
Where do you stand on this?
As to whether a young child should be helped to die?
Yeah.
If the child is going to die anyway? Is that the question?
Well, it doesn't follow that all these children will be terminally ill. Some of them are simply in very distressing circumstances, facing a life of great suffering. But to take your example of a child that is going to die anyway, one can say that is true of a terminally ill person at the other end of life. Do you think that it's appropriate for doctors to aid the death process?
It's certainly appropriate for them to make the person comfortable and to do all that can be done to exercise compassion and care towards that person until the end.
Okay. Archbishop Eames, Bishop in the Church of England, Tom Butler, I think in this case speaking on behalf of the Church of England, making representation to the Nuffield Council, suggested that we are in new territory here, mm-hmm. scientifically, and we're in new territory morally, and that the traditional opposition to, shall we describe it as passive euthanasia, and some people describe it as active euthanasia, needs to be looked at again.
Well, first of all, I didn't agree with everything in that report. It's a report I think needs studied in depth, and I think it is saying things that personally I would have some difficulty with. There's one element to this whole picture you haven't mentioned, William, and that is the whole question of the whole way in which the health resources, the ability of medicine to reach out to people, and the scientific development in medicine is so often controlled in our modern society by finance. What is available, what is allowable,
yes.
What is... Now, so far as the question of a young child who's terminally ill is concerned, I have a simple reaction to that from the point of view of my faith. That child has been created through the love of God. That child has entered the world in some way disabled,
yeah.
or whatever. I have to relate my belief in the love of God for that child, for its parents, for the people that surround that family in terms of the loving care of that child, to the whole question of what is possible from a medical point of view, what is possible from the point of view of relieving suffering, not just the physical suffering, but the tremendous suffering of that family unit. And it is an extremely complicated question, which at this moment I don't believe beckons a very easy answer. I believe that quite frankly, as long as that child is alive, some of the love of God can be seen through that child to those who are surrounding it, to those who are related to it. And it may go back to your former question, it may not answer the pet scientific view,
yeah,
or fit into a neat cabinet or drawer, but I believe that you cannot generalize. Every one of these cases is different.
But you're not ruling out the possibility in the future that that we would be able to assist children in these cases?
I'm not ruling that out, because that's not the question I think that's important. The question is, where are we at this point? And at this point, I think science is still an awful lot to answer.
I think every human life must be protected from the first moment of its existence until its end. And I think the role of the doctor is to sustain life, help life. And even the Hippocratic Oath binds doctors to do that. But that doesn't mean that the extraordinary means have to be implied. There must be a distinction made. But the fact that every human life can also elicit great love and care from those around, and that is a good which must be assessed and appreciated.
I mean, as pastors, we visit homes where children are born with handicaps, Down syndrome and so on. And the parents, while they may have been dismayed when a child arrived with these conditions, the amount of love that they give and the amount of joy and love that they receive back is something that's uplifting to behold.
Sure. Do you think it's sometimes legitimate, justified, David Clark, for a mother to terminate a pregnancy on the basis that she's been told that it's very likely that her child will have very severe disabilities?
In a sense, I'm going back to what I've said. I mean, that women who have carried children to full term and then found themselves with children with disabilities are amazed at the love that they discover and the joy that they have in that child's life. And I don't want to go down that road at all.